Where'd you go to college? Where are your kids going? These can be very fraught questions, especially in America, where the cost and status associated with private universities is out of proportion with their actual educational value. How our system reinforces class boundaries is the subject of Poison Ivy, How Elite Colleges Divide Us by Evan Mandery. Evan is a professor at the City University of New York and has written for the New York Times and Politico. Here he is with five big ideas.
For several years, I took a train between two worlds. At one end was an affluent suburb where 70% of the people are white and the average family income is nearly $250,000 per year. At the other was John Jay College of Criminal Justice, part of the City University of New York, where I've taught for the past 23 years. At CUNY, just 16% of the students are white, and more than half come from families earning less than $20,000. The chasm between the fortunes of the people I lived with and the brilliant, hard-working young men and women whom I taught was massive. Almost no one who attends John Jay lives in a wealthy suburb. Almost no one from a wealthy suburb will attend a college like John Jay. My name is Evan Mandery, and this train ride is an apt metaphor for my life, most of which I've spent in schools traversing class boundaries. Over the past four decades, I've taught almost every type of student in every imaginable environment. And I'm here to report that America maintains an apartheid education system. Now, that's probably not a surprise to you. The inequities of American education, particularly at the elementary and secondary level, have been well documented. But for the most part, America's elite colleges, which are overwhelmingly rich and white, have denied responsibility. Elite colleges look the way they do, they say, because America looks the way it does. What if the causal chain is reversed? What if America looks the way it does because elite colleges look the way they do? My book, Poison Ivy, How Elite Colleges Divide Us, began on a bet. I was at dinner with a close friend who argued that, all things considered, Harvard was a force for good. If you belong to the next Big Idea book club, chances are pretty good that you've got a fancy degree yourself. Maybe you've even made an argument similar to my friend's. My friend was repeating a story that Harvard tells, a story of access and diversity. I'll argue that almost every element of it is a myth. Not a lie exactly, but as misleading as the TV commercials run by energy giants, celebrating the pittance they spend on gravity lights and bio beans while ignoring the hundreds of millions they spend lobbying to defend their right to emit carbon dioxide. Elite colleges cement class hierarchies, and their principal partner are affluent suburbs. That train I used to take is at the heart of what segregates America. Upon having children, most affluent, yes, white families either send their kids to private school or flee the city for a wealthy suburb. They're chasing access to lacrosse teams, science programs, and the sort of distinguishing excellences that elite colleges arbitrarily choose to value and affluent suburbs are uniquely able to provide. These communities organize to do everything within their power to land their children at an elite college. Elite colleges cement class hierarchies, and their principal partner are affluent suburbs. That train I used to take is at the heart of what segregates America. Upon having children, most affluent, yes, white families either send their kids to private school or flee the city for a wealthy suburb. They're chasing access to lacrosse teams, science programs, and the sort of distinguishing excellences that elite colleges arbitrarily choose to value and affluent suburbs are uniquely able to provide. These communities organize to do everything within their power to land their children at an elite college. This, I argue, is the organizing principle of upper-class American society. Now, I understand how challenging this statement will be to many readers and listeners, but Poison Ivy is at bottom a story of hope. It's filled with inspiring stories of students, scholars, and educators who've helped to illuminate how the system functions, and with workable reforms that can transform these institutions, make our communities more fluid, and fight the epidemic of inequality that plagues America. What's more, you can make a difference. If by chance you do have one of those fancy degrees, listen, without you, nothing will happen. Universities will not change until their faculty, students, and alumni demand that they do. So I hope you'll join me in this work. If you're so inclined, I'd like to offer five lessons I've learned from the experts who have described the inequities in American higher ed with the clearest vision and who've done the most to change it. 1. Look both down and up. Maybe you've seen a made-for-TV movie called Homeless to Harvard. It's about a young woman named Liz Murray's journey from the foster care system to Harvard's freshman class. It's inspirational. It's also basically the movie poster for the story that elite colleges tell about themselves. Their website and brochures are filled with the images of students that these colleges have helped lift out of poverty. And these good works are worthy of praise, but they're only part of the story. When my friend and I had dinner, he hinged a lot of his argument on Harvard's financial aid initiative. Many colleges now have similar programs. Harvard's allowed anyone whose family made under $65,000 to attend for free. This begged the question, I said. How many Harvard students came from families making less than $65,000? Now, for context, the median U.S. household income was $52,000. I said that if anywhere near half of Harvard students came from families making less than $65,000, I'd buy. It wasn't even close. More came from families in the top 1% than the bottom 50. We settled our bet using data from the Harvard Crimson's freshman survey. Soon, our understanding of opportunity in higher ed would be immeasurably enriched by a groundbreaking study based on millions of tax filings and tuition records. The picture painted by the economists Raj Chetty and John Friedman was worse than anyone imagined. I'll give you three highlights. The average Harvard student came from a family making $505,000 per year. As many students came from families in the top 0.1% as the bottom 20. And overall, 38 American colleges had more students from the top 1% than the bottom 60. Chetty and Friedman's data also proved something that we'd already suspected, that elite colleges are the surest way to reach the stratosphere of wealth. They're the gatekeepers to jobs in the investment banking, management consulting, and technology sectors, industries that set the national agenda and, of course, pay handsomely. One way of looking at their data is this. If you imagined that you were at Princeton's 10th reunion, for every graduate in the room that had been lifted from poverty, there would be 40 rich kids who'd remained rich. So remember to look both up and down. Lesson two, look both inside and outside. Perhaps the biggest obstacle to educational justice is that the mechanisms that fuel inequities are, at bottom, excesses of kindness. When someone at the country club helps their golfing buddy's nephew land an internship at Goldman Sachs or writes him a letter of recommendation to Yale, this feels like doing good. It's easy to forget who gets left behind. Consider this last data point from Chetty and Friedman. If you're born into an American family in the top 0.1%, meaning they make about $600,000 a year, there's about a 40% chance that you'll end up at a school in the top tier of the Barron's rankings. Schools like Middlebury, Amherst, Wesleyan, or one of the Ivies. If you're born into the bottom income quintile, meaning you make less than about $20,000, the chance of you ending up at an elite college is less than 0.5%. A majority of the poorest kids in America won't attend any college at all. It's easy to forget, too, the stories that we tell about the people who get left behind. If Ivy League colleges were honest, they'd remind their entering freshmen that most of them were the winners in a game where the table had been tilted in their favor from the start. Instead, they teach them that they're the best and the brightest. Elite colleges pretend as if the higher education system rewards merit rather than affluence. Recently, a cottage industry has arisen of intellectuals, mostly professors at elite colleges, exposing the construct of meritocracy as a myth. But that construct didn't emerge from the ether. It's cultivated by the colleges themselves. Shortly after assuming office, former Stanford president John Hennessy offered a typical message to the entering freshman class at a school where the mean family income is around $500,000 per year. "Our admission office is one of the best in the country," Hennessy said, "and we don't make mistakes." That's the American myth of meritocracy. The downside is that it implicitly frames disadvantage as a failure of skill and effort. This leads to a politics of humiliation and legitimizes grievances with the system. From here, it's easy enough to draw a straight line to Trumpism. Of the many hateful mechanisms Trump exploited on his pathway to the presidency, none was quite so effective as his critique of elites, a ploy the University of Pennsylvania graduate borrowed from Adolf Hitler. Ford Foundation President Darren Walker draws a careful distinction between generosity and justice. Generosity is about the size of the gift, Justice is about the underlying systemic problems, and it requires consideration of both the good and harm caused. As Walker puts it, generosity makes the donor feel good. Justice implicates the donor. Harvard has a $53 billion endowment. Princeton has an endowment of $4.4 million per student, enough to run the college in perpetuity for free. Giving to these schools is generous, but not just. Next time the development office calls, remember who's being left outside. Lesson 3, things don't have to be this way. I don't know about you, but I'd feel a lot different about Ivy League colleges if they produced a lot of do-gooders. But that's not how it goes. In a survey of Harvard's class of 2020, 63% of seniors entering the workforce said they plan to go into consulting, finance, or technology. Just 4% intended to enter public service or work for a nonprofit. When I shared this data with a friend of mine who's the public interest advisor at an elite school, she said it simply reflected kids' underlying attitudes. But research by the sociologist Amy Binder shows that the overwhelming majority of students enter college undecided on a career. Very few start out wanting to be an investment banker. They gravitate toward finance out of high achieverism, and after elite colleges show them no obvious alternative to working on Wall Street. Or at least none with significant status and prestige. But it doesn't have to be this way. When Clayton Spencer took the helm of Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, she defined her presidency around work. Under her leadership, Bates opened a center that encourages faculty to connect their courses to discussions of meaning and careers, created practitioner-in-residence positions, and built a course to help students think about the architecture of their life. The leading career choices among Bates graduates are education and healthcare, which respectively attract 17 and 13% of their graduates. At Harvard, the equivalent numbers are 2 and 4. The Bates Center for Purposeful Work is hardly a panacea, but it shows that it's at least possible to shift what elite colleges do with their degrees. Similarly, small changes could make a big difference in the diversity of who gets into these schools. Ending legacy and donor preference, limiting early decision, creating pipeline programs with neighborhood schools, and expanding capacity are just some of the many ideas advanced by experts that could make elite colleges engines of opportunity instead of class stratification. Lesson 4, Know the Midnight. One of the coolest people I met in the course of writing my book is a man named Simon Cataldo. He's now a lawyer running for state rep in Massachusetts, but in 2010, he was a recent college graduate doing Teach for America at a high school in Harlem and on the verge of despair. No matter what he tried, he couldn't get through to his students. He was ready to quit when on a trade ride home for Thanksgiving, he had the idea to teach his kids lacrosse. Today, Harlem Lacrosse and Leadership has programs on 18 sites in 5 cities and serves about 1,300 students each year. Less than 10% of whom are white. It's far and away the largest provider of opportunity in lacrosse to young men and women of color. The commonality of the people I met who've done the most to create opportunity and soften segregating borders is that they've gotten out of their bubble. The poet Robert Frost, who toiled in obscurity until he was almost 40 years old, called it knowing the midnight. The lawyer and human rights activist Bryan Stevenson calls it proximity to suffering. We cannot change global injustice if we isolate ourselves in places that are safe and removed and disconnected, he says. To change the world, we're each going to have to find ways to get closer to people who are living on the margins of society. Living in the high noon without ever seeing the midnight promotes a sort of blindness. When you live in the suburbs and your children attend wealthy schools, it's easy to tell yourself that you've earned your place, that your family deserves its privileged status. 5. Understand your own power. Lesson number 5 is this. You can make a difference. Colleges and universities are complex organizations, but they ultimately respond to what their students, faculty, and alumni say. When the development office calls asking for money, tell them that you won't donate unless the college makes a meaningful commitment to increasing the racial and socioeconomic diversity of its student body. That doesn't mean increasing financial aid for upper-middle-class families. It means creating real pathways for poor students and students of color that have long been the birthright of affluent whites. In other words, be generous and just, know the midnight, and demand that the billions of dollars raised by elite institutions with taxpayer support be used to fuel the American dream, not to thwart it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Evan. That was Evan Mandery with 5 Big Ideas from Poison Ivy, How Elite Colleges Divide Us. You might also want to listen to our book bite for Broken, How Our Social Systems Are Failing Us and How We Can Fix Them by Paul LeBlanc. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.